Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron Elving, I want to congratulate you on your very prophetic performance in last week's podcast. You said without any hesitation that Rick Santorum may not survive to the next podcast.
Before we do another podcast, Rick Santorum will have officially ended his campaign.
Wow.
I believe he will do it on Monday, the day after Easter,
wow,
April 9th, or at the latest, perhaps April 10th on Tuesday.
In all fairness, Ron Elving, the rare times you say something that is absolutely idiotic, like Rudy Giuliani is going to be the nominee in 2008.
No, it's Fred Thompson.
Well, you said both. And I thought you were a stupid idiot.
I thought I was pretty stupid idiot, too.
Well, you said things, and I pointed out things that I thought you were wrong. And yet, this not only were you completely right, but I was amazed with the certainty that you made that prediction. I was very, very impressed.
I'd had a vision. I'd had an epiphany. If he got out this week, 2 weeks before the Pennsylvania primary, before it was clear whether he was going to win or not.
Which we were not sure of.
Absolutely. Very much up in the air. But that's the point. If he can't be sure of winning his own home state, he confronts the prospect of getting booted out of the presidential race by his own home state in much the way he was booted out of the Senate in 2006 by his own home state. And that would be a bad ending for this whole remarkable run that he has had, which should go into the books on a more positive sort of score.
Well, let's talk about the positive stuff first. Remember, when we were doing this podcast a year ago, talking about the Republican field, Rick Santorum was the one name we didn't talk about at all as a front runner. We talked about the Michelle Bachmann and the Herman Cain and the Rick Perrys and the Newt Gingrich. Everybody was the flavor of the month, the Romney alternative of the month or of the week, and it was never Rick Santorum.
We went to every single base and never to Rick Santorum.
So he did much better than anybody expected, perhaps maybe even better than he expected. He won 10 or 11 contests, if you include Missouri, and we're not sure if we include
Beauty
Missouri.
Contest, yeah, but well, whatever.
So let's say 11 contests. He did lose 26, and not many people lose that many and go on to the nomination. Although, for the record, did you know that Barack Obama lost 20 primaries in 2008 to Hillary Clinton?
And that's so, right, and many of them toward the end of the year, and many of them in states with
big
names
states
like New York, Texas,
California.
You know, I mean, he lost 7 or 8 of the
Ohio,
top 10
Pennsylvania,
states
right,
in population, and many of them late in the process.
But all the reason for his ultimate withdrawal from the primary, the likelihood that he was not going to get the nomination, that he was way behind the delegates, that the precarious health of his daughter, Bella, who now has pneumonia in the lungs and has a genetic disorder and has been sick for much of the campaign. We all knew that, though. I mean, and we've been saying that for
but
weeks.
It has
and
to
weeks
come together. It has to come together in a certain mix at
and
a
he also
moment.
Met with the evangelical leaders the weekend before as Bella was coming out of the hospital. And I think he wanted to say, okay, now what? Because the same questions, except for the health of the daughter and stuff, things like that, many of the same questions still hold true for Newt Gingrich. The funniest thing is that for the longest time, Rick Santorum was talking about, get Newt Gingrich out of the race so I can go one-on-one with Mitt Romney. Now he's out of the race, and Newt Gingrich is suddenly saying to his supporters, or supporter, just like our listener, I'm going one-on-one because I'm the conservative alternative.
And people are turning to Newt Gingrich in droves, or not. Look, Newt Gingrich has been a vanity candidate for a very long time. He was a vanity candidate who was leading in the polls for a period of time as Republican primary participants looked around for an alternative to Mitt Romney and eventually came around to Rick Santorum. There was a time, a month, maybe 6 weeks or so, when Gingrich was doing so well in key states and in the national poll that he could sit there on national television and say, I will be the nominee.
Well, he was,
and he probably even started to think it himself.
Yeah.
But he was a vanity candidate all along. He never spent his money like a real candidate. When he got
what
money,
money?
Well, he got money from Sheldon Adelson in January. And where did he spend it? He spent it on making sure that he wasn't piling up a huge debt as a candidate. He didn't get it on TV in South Carolina in a meaningful way. Didn't get it on TV in Florida where he got skunked. And that's why he lost his position as the alternative to Romney.
And he certainly didn't get it in the upcoming Utah primary where his $500 check to get on the Utah June 26th ballot bounced.
Exactly. So, and this is the kind of campaign he has run all along. He never intended, when he got into this, to be doing much more than expanding his brand and taking care of his many businesses, one of which declared for bankruptcy just a couple weeks ago. And look, I mean, this thing was much more successful than Newt Gingrich ever expected it to be. And then in the end, after it had had that one big flare-up, it's been much less successful than he could have ever thought. He didn't think he would fall this far. But now he's essentially suspended his campaign. He finished fourth in Wisconsin, yeah. his wife's home state.
That's the state you predicted Rick Santorum would win. Is that correct?
At one time, I thought Santorum would, and at one time, Santorum was going to. He was ahead in the polls, but then, of course, came the regular routine Romney carpet bombing. I'm not taking it personally.
No. You know the people, I still remember to this day, the people who predicted Cassius Clay would beat Sonny Liston. I will always remember Ron Elving on this podcast saying that Rick Santorum would be out. Now, the question is, what to make of the Santorum candidacy? Was it good or bad for Mitt Romney? And what did Santorum bring? Was he a good candidate? You did notice that he did not even mention Mitt Romney's name during his withdrawal.
Not once. And in that night, he went and did an event at a Bible college there in Pennsylvania. Didn't talk about Mitt Romney there either. Not in any hurry to get in with the program, along with the many, many, many people who jumped on the bandwagon and endorsed Mitt Romney this week, including the other senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, the Republican, who was, if you will, a kind of Rick Santorum figure to some degree in the state and yet had never endorsed Rick Santorum.
Well, of course, because he's still angry at him, Rick Santorum, for endorsing Arlen Specter over Pat Toomey in 2004. But that's
just a little sidelight. Yeah. But let's say that Rick Santorum slowly gets on board by the time we get to Tampa. He wants to be thought of as a vice presidential shortlister. I don't think it's really realistic. He could be in position for some kind of a job in the Romney administration. Some people have suggested ambassador to the Vatican might be the sort of thing Rick Santorum would enjoy.
What about just run for Pope?
And then, if there is no Romney administration, Rick Santorum gets out to Iowa when? Approximately spring of 2013.
I was going to say, how about November 7th, 2012?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as, if this were to happen, if Barack Obama were to win a second term, I think Rick Santorum would be out in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida and a lot of these states very quickly and trying to consolidate early on the social conservative vote and expand beyond that vote so that he could possibly be seen as a front runner in 2016.
We always said that Hillary Clinton made Barack Obama a better candidate, and the longer that race went on, the better Obama was as a candidate in the debates on the issues. Do we think that Rick Santorum made Mitt Romney a better candidate, or did he move Romney and the party so far to the right that they're going to have difficulty getting back to the middle?
Well, see, that's the larger question. Does the Republican Party succeed when it nominates a clear-cut conservative who heightens the contrast with the Democrat 1980 Ronald Reagan against Jimmy Carter? Or does the Republican Party win when it nominates somebody who is a little bit more centrist, a little bit more in the middle, and somebody who could conceivably bring those independents back from Barack Obama who voted for him in 2008? That's a huge question. That is essentially the political question facing the Republican Party, and you're posing it in terms of, you know, Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney, and my guess is Santorum forced Romney to say a lot of things he would have just as soon never put on the record, and he has forced him into a position where he seems much more unfriendly to the social dynamics of change of the era. And all of that is forcing Mitt Romney to start the presidential one-on-one with Barack Obama with a deficit, maybe 5 points, maybe 10 points, depending on what poll and what state you're looking at, particularly among women. And that has really become the focal point of this week.
The Obama administration and the Democrats thought they had the Romney folks on the run
and
about women.
And they did.
Gender pay equality, all those issues that they were trying to run on against Romney and the Republicans. So Hillary Rosen comes out and basically says that Ann Romney, how could Mitt Romney turn to Ann Romney for advice?
Guess what? His wife has actually never worked a day in her life. She's never really dealt with the kinds of economic issues that a majority of the women in this country are facing in terms of how do we feed our kids.
Wonderful. And she has raised a family of five. Right. And not to mention being a politician's wife, which I think we can all agree is pretty hard work under any circumstances. And so with that one remark, Hillary Rosen, who is not officially a part of the Obama campaign, but who's closely identified with the Democratic Party, and she's been to the White House more times than David Petraeus, as the Romney campaign was quick to point out. So they're going to hang Hillary Rosen around the Obama campaign's neck like 4 years ago we saw Jeremiah Wright.
Look, but I still think if you're going to talk about Rush Limbaugh and the things he says and how it affects the Republican Party and the Romney campaign negatively, I think that what Hillary Rosen says is absolutely equally fair game to hold around the Democrats' neck. That a key Democratic advisor works with the DNC, has worked with Democratic candidates for years, says this thing, which many Democrats, including David Axelrod, Jim Messina, have all said, this is just wrong and offensive and you shouldn't be saying this. But I think this came at the worst possible time. Look, will it be forgotten in a week or two? Maybe. Who knows? But right now, at least, that the offensive that the White House and the Obama campaign was trying to go on vis-a-vis Romney and women seemed to just hit a roadblock right there with Hillary Rosen.
You had a gender gap in the 2008 election of Obama and John McCain, essentially tied among men, Obama a few votes ahead among men, but Obama had 57% to 43% right. among women. Now, that was obviously enough to win him the presidency 2-1 in the Electoral College. Tied among men, 14-point gap among women. Obviously, the Republicans don't want to see that happen again, and right now the polls, just until this week, were showing that that gap was actually getting wider in the battleground states. It was out to like 20 points almost. So this is a mortal threat.
Partly because of what we heard during a lot of these Republican primaries about contraception, women's rights, all those kind of things that even for conservative Republicans that would seem to be off limits in previous years, but not this year. Thanks in part to Rick Santorum.
No question. This was the impact of Santorum more than anybody else. And if you talk about contraception, you unite the women's vote. If you talk about whether it's work to work at home or whether it's only work if you work at home and have a job, then you divide the women's vote. So that's great political strategy from one standpoint, and probably a better argument than the other one Romney has tried this week, which was arguing that most of the jobs, in fact 90% or more of the jobs lost in this recession, were jobs done by women.
The Romney campaign is clearly trying to make the point that in the more recent job losses, it's women who have suffered the larger proportion of the job losses.
That's right, and it has been disproportionately women in the more recent stages of the job loss period, mostly because of the government sector, because the public sector has been shedding jobs for the past couple of years, and a lot of jobs that government workers have are teaching, nursing, administrative work that are disproportionately represented by women. In the early part of the downturn, it was construction jobs and jobs of that kind, which are disproportionately men. But it's a tough sell to go out and tell everybody that this recession has been 90% women's jobs. It just doesn't resonate with people's experience. Most people have seen the recession as costing people their jobs irrespective of gender.
Well,
and it's just not going to be that successful an argument. Much better politics.
Well, you understand why they're doing it. Of course, the Romney campaign is on the defensive about women, and so therefore they'll say it's women who were suffering the most under Obama. Just like there's a lot of ways of describing what the Buffett rule can accomplish, but what Obama's trying to do, obviously, is to remind people that if Warren Buffett pays the same tax rate, effectively the same tax rate as his secretary, it links Warren Buffett with another rich guy who happens to run for president, Mitt Romney.
Right. And the whole purpose of the Buffett rule really is to emphasize that people who make large amounts of money, even enormous amounts of money, strictly through investments, that is to say capital gains, dividends, interest, those people are paying at a lower rate because those kinds of income receive a tax preference.
We saw with Romney's numbers, what, 14%?
He's paying about 14% on millions of dollars in annual income, whereas somebody who works for a living, and perhaps those particularly who work for a living and make a fairly high wage, are paying 20 or 30% on their income in federal income tax terms. So this is an inequity in the law, or perceived by Democrats and others as being an inequity in the law that they would like to highlight and they'd like to stick in Mitt Romney's face. Republicans come back to say, well, what good does it do for the secretary if you charge your boss more taxes? It doesn't do any good for her. And there'll also be the argument that even if you did tax millionaires at 30%, it's not going to make much difference to the deficit and it's not going to make much difference to the economy. So you would be doing it just in essence to stick it to the millionaires.
But Ron, I want to pivot to the Senate races because now it's my turn to make a prediction. I think that Dick Lugar is going to lose his primary on May 8th to Richard Murdoch in that Indiana Senate primary.
Do you really? You really think that's going to go down? All right, well, you know, that's a bold prediction. Here's a man, 36 years in the Senate. He's been...
Me?
Dick Lugar, 36 years in the Senate. He's been elected ever since 1976.
Who do you beat, by the way, to come to the Senate? Ron, my car's in a meter.
Oh, no. Helmke?
Let me give you a hint. It sounds exactly like Vance Hartke.
Helmke. Isn't that what I said? I said Helmke.
No, there's a Helmke who's a Republican.
That's right. But it was Vance Hartke, yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But I think Lugar's going to lose. And that's pretty remarkable because he's lucky he's allowed to vote. I think all these other issues that he could have dealt with much easier than he did, all he had to do was buy a residence somewhere in Indiana.
You mean, you're talking about the fact that he didn't live in the state.
That really hurts.
Now, he was relying for a long, long time, for several terms, on the fact that the family still owned a farm.
Yeah.
The family still owned a farm, and so he would talk about my farm back in Indiana, and nobody stopped to say, did you ever live there? Or did you actually go back there the last time you were in the state, which he wasn't doing.
No, and as a matter of fact, he was going back and renting hotel rooms and then charging it to the Senate, which you can't do.
It was a bad thing, and he repaid the federal government, and yes, it's a black eye for him, but does the state of Indiana really want to give up one of the most distinguished senators?
We're not talking about the state of Indiana. We're talking about the Republican Party of Indiana, and which is far more conservative than Richard Lugar. I mean, at least he could have been very clever, like Bob Kerry, saying, oh, yeah, I live in Nebraska. I mean, I'm living at my sister's house. That works for me. Or I'm living in the attic or the basement of a funder for my campaign.
Look, I mean, I think these residence things are, you know, a little overblown. Somebody is elected to the Senate. He goes to Washington, D.C. He buys a home there. His family moves with him. This was 36 years ago, and I realize these things don't happen anymore. But if a person is going to serve in the United States Senate, it's not unreasonable to think that he might want to actually live there in Washington and serve in that Senate. That was the old custom. He is being barbecued for having moved mentally, politically, emotionally to Washington, D.C., and that's his vulnerability. It used to be that seniority was a purely good thing in the Senate, and you would go back home and tell people about how long you'd been there and how much you could bring home for them. Now that's turned into a negative.
And that's not what his opponent actually ran on. His opponent ran on the fact that Lugar was President Obama's favorite Republican, that he votes with the White House more often than any Republican should. And yet, the simple thing like residence could mean the difference in a May 8th primary.
On the other hand, Orrin Hatch, who's also been serving since 1976 from Utah, seems to have smelled the Tea Party coffee way back, if you can have coffee at a tea party.
Ooh, okay. Ooh, that would be grounds for divorce.
He really seemed to get it back in 2009 when the Tea Party was first organizing, having their first rallies, having events at the National Press Club. And Orrin Hatch would show up uninvited, just show up and say, whoa, I'm a member of the Tea Party. People would say, no, you're not. Well, you're a member of the United States Senate, and we don't like you. And
what
he
really
kept
happened,
coming back
what
and
really,
coming back.
What really happened was a defeat of Bob Bennett in 2010 by the Tea Party at the state convention. And when Bob Bennett, who by almost anybody's account is a conservative, but not conservative enough, when he went down, finished third in the running for the Republican nomination, the seat that Mike Lee won, Orrin Hatch said, uh-oh, I think I better pay attention to this lesson here.
Yes, but I would submit that Orrin Hatch was on it early on. Even before Bob Bennett got into trouble, Orrin Hatch could sense that this was a gathering movement, that this was a sense of dissatisfaction. It was the vote on TARP, the Toxic Asset Relief Program. It was the vote on many things. And Orrin Hatch said, I'm vulnerable here. There was all that tape of me making, you know, friendly sorts of gestures towards Ted Kennedy and doing radio programs together. And I better be good to these Tea Party folks. He was way ahead of it, even before Bob Bennett went down. So when he gets to his Saturday convention here later this month,
what will happen? April 21st. Yeah, you know, he certainly finishes first. The question is whether he gets a 60% that would negate the need for a primary. But I assume one way or the other, he finishes first. One lesson that doesn't seem to be learned by a Republican leader is Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader from Virginia. We know that in the Illinois primary, he supported Adam Kinzinger against Don Manzullo, incumbent versus incumbent. That's fine. And he gave money to Kinzinger.
But he was giving money, interestingly enough, he was giving money to the younger member there.
Right.
Not to the more senior person whom you would think the majority leader would have more loyalty to, but not in this case.
But he also gave $25,000 to the super PAC called Campaign for Primary Accountability, which, of course, was also opposing Manzullo. But the Campaign for Primary Accountability also opposes other Republican incumbents.
Oops.
Yeah, oops.
And oops.
Why would Eric Cantor do that? He said, well, my real goal was to re-elect Adam Kinzinger, but by giving money to a super PAC that is also targeting Republicans, a lot of Republicans in the House caucus not happy with that.
You know, not every move made by smart people is a smart move.
okay, we're acknowledging that Eric Cantor did make a mistake here. It seems like the Democrats may be making some kind of a mistake in the Wisconsin recall, because initially the Democrats were united against Scott Walker. They got the recall, enough signatures to get the recall on the ballot June 5th. But now the Democrats are battling each other in the May primary to see who will face Scott Walker.
That's right. But that could also be a necessary move for the Democrats, because if they were not to have a battle, they would have had to have endorsed and nominated Kathleen Falk, the former county executive for Dane County, which is Madison. And she is the favorite of the labor unions.
Clearly.
And the labor unions have really provided all the financial muscle for this recall movement. But in the end, they can't provide all the votes. They need more votes than they can muscle up with just their hardcore base. So they have to expand their appeal more broadly. And Kathleen Falk is not likely to be able to do that. The polls show Barrett is a stronger candidate. Tom Barrett is the mayor of Milwaukee. He was previously a legislator. He was in the Congress. And he also almost beat Scott Walker back in 2010.
In a very good Republican year.
In a very good Republican year, he ran well. And he brought out the Democratic vote, which is what's necessary to win this recall election on June 5th. Also, Herb Kohl, who is still the most popular figure in the state politically and probably could have won in a walk if he were the candidate to replace Scott Walker as governor, has come out. He refused to run himself, but he's come out in favor of Dom Barrett. And that signals that, if you will, the slightly more independent, the slightly less labor-oriented elements of the Democratic vote in the state will probably go with Barrett.
Remember, we've talked all year about whether the Republicans in the presidential contest care more about ideology and what is a true conservative, or do they want to beat Obama in November? I think that's what the Democratic decision may be on May 8th. In their hearts, maybe Kathleen Falk is the better candidate because she's a true believer in labor causes. But Tom Barrett does look like a stronger candidate, has the endorsement of Dave Obey and Herb Kohl and many big names in the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. Having come very close to Scott Walker in 2010, he could come equally close, if not beat him, in 2012.
I agree. And now that we have found an issue on which we can agree, I would say that's it for this week's political podcast.
No, you can't. And you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
And I am Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy and you let it. 9 to 5 or 7.